Immigrants have been serving in the U.S. military since 1775. Irish, French, and German soldiers were imperative to winning the Revolutionary War. And in the 1940s, Filipino nationals were recruited en masse by the U.S. Navy. In a 2009 effort to combat declining enlistment, the military created a recruitment program called Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest. It's an exchange program of sorts. Immigrants with specialized linguistic skills or highly trained medical backgrounds could serve and be on an expedited track to citizenship. The program met vital military needs, particularly in the post-9/11 world, and recruitment of immigrant soldiers spiked. The program has produced recruits that are generally better educated and better performing than the average enlisted soldier. In the last 2 years, though, the program's background checks have become more rigorous, and service members with temporary immigration status waiting to be cleared are now being deemed unsuitable to serve. Many who have waited and banked on acquiring citizenship through the program may now face deportation. Reporter Alex Horton has been writing about this topic for the Washington Post and joins us today. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So start off by telling us what this program is, the Military Accession Vital to the National Interest Program. It also has an acronym, MAVNI, I suppose, right?
Yeah, and I'll be using that acronym, MAVNI, throughout this conversation. So it's all in the title. You know, during the Bush administration, the Pentagon war planners were looking at their needs, and they discovered that there were shortfalls for native-born troops coming in who could perform vital skills like surgery and dentistry, but also who could have native fluency in, Chinese, Mandarin, and Russian, and Ukrainian, and dialects of French in Africa. So it created this program to say, look, we can't draw Americans who are born in this country to do this because we need education, we need experience. That incentives are hard to come by. So if we have immigrants that live here and they're already vetted, they already have visas, then we can fast track their citizenship. So in 2009, this started. And since then, there's been about 10,000 of these folks that have come in the force.
So and so those are the two main areas of special skills, right? Language and medical skills, right? Are there any other major categories?
Those are the two categories. So it's okay. Language and culture kind of wedded into one.
Right.
You have people who are, if you have troops in Afghanistan or Niger or Ukraine, then you really need those bridges to those cultures, that someone who is born there, who speaks the language, but also has the American background to then turn it into something that, American troops can understand and use.
And originally the program was only open to immigrants with citizenship, yes?
No. I mean, by definition, they've always opened it up to non-citizens, because the deal is that you become naturalized,
right,
in the force.
Okay. So what issues did the Army keep running into while trying to train recruits in these special skills?
So there weren't too many hiccups along the way the first few years. And this is a pilot program that's based on a year contract, and then the Pentagon just renews it every year. It shut down, a few years ago, mostly from challenges from putting people in billets that made sense. So if you were born in Afghanistan and you spoke Pashto and you try to join the Army and they said, well, we're going to make you a truck driver, that was a bit of a challenge to really get these people where they needed to go. And the Army has always been very mediocre when it comes to talent management and getting the people where they need to go to better use their skills. So that was one of the big problems before 2016. So in 2016, the Army said, okay, we're going to continue the program for another year. However, we think we have identified some soft spots, maybe some areas where if you are nefarious, then you can exploit this. If you're, say, from a country that has an ISIS presence, maybe you're an ISIS recruit and you want to be sort of an insider threat. So they, in 2016, in September, they introduced these more rigorous standards that made the clearance about as rigorous as it is for someone to get a top secret security clearance. But this is just a background check. So that doesn't allow them to access any classified information, but it checks out their family history, their loyalty to the United States, looks into their finances. It's extremely rigorous for people who have already been screened by the Department of Homeland Security and Department of State. And this is much more rigorous than, American troops like myself. I was in the Army. much more rigorous than we would have been screened for born in the United States.
And the rigorous nature of the screening process, has that evolved over time, say post 9/11, or I mean, the program is not as old as 9/11, but is it, since 2009, has it evolved over time, the rigor of that program,
the vetting? Yeah, so 2016 is when the vetting got much more extreme, and the barriers were so much higher. And so that's where the problem started to emerge, because the checks were so complex and so complicated that they started to build a backlog and a logjam of all of these applicants. So you had a population of folks who typically pursued education to stay in the country and had student visas. They had to give those up to join the military. But then the Pentagon was taking so long that they were starting to lose status. They feared they would get deported. You know, if you're a Russian immigrant and you want to get you want to stay in this country, but you are fear of getting deported after you enlisted and signed a contract with the U.S. military, I don't think the Russian government is going to look too kindly on you. The same thing happens in China and Indonesia, in a place like Iraq that really has weak institutions and laws to protect you. So last year and the end of 2016, folks panicked. They feared deportation. They feared going back to a country where they would be stripped of citizenship. And the Pentagon really hasn't fixed this. They haven't fixed the logjam. They haven't processed in enough people on a routine basis. And in one instance, the Army Recruiting Command sent out a misunderstood memo to its recruiters that ended up with the result of a bunch of contracts being canceled for erroneous reasons. So there's been a lot of hiccups and challenges and difficulties and failures from the Pentagon to address this that really haven't been resolved yet.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Washington Post reporter Alex Horton about his investigation into the treatment of immigrants serving in the U.S. military. So the program was closed in September of 2016, right?
So it was extended for one more year, and then it was quietly deactivated last year. Okay. When they ran into many more problems.
Since 2009, more than 10,000 troops have gone through the program. Why now has the government become concerned with the possible terrorist or espionage threats?
It's difficult to assess what's going on, you know, behind closed doors. The Pentagon has not been forthcoming or transparent on their review. They have released some statistics. They have said that since 2013, they have investigated 20 people for national security type threats through the program. They do not. I've asked them for a long time now, for almost a year straight, were any of those people charged? Were any of those threats deemed to be serious or legitimate? And they haven't said yet, just that they were investigated. And so one of the things that has been happening lately, as people have been kicked out for or stopped in their enlistment in this program for derogatory information. And that sounds scary, but sometimes it just means that they'll look into your history and see that you're from India, and they can't get a hold of your Indian grandmother or your first boss when you were 16, and they can't close your file and sign you off to make sure you are who you say you are.
That's not really a threat, right? I mean,
well, yes, the Army and the Pentagon haven't been able to sort of bifurcate these things.
Right.
They don't tell us the difference between this guy from Iraq is actually an ISIS sympathizer and he's made threats and we found it in his file, versus someone says, well, we can't let this person in because they have foreign military contacts. And if you're from South Korea, where there is conscription, your foreign military contact might be the name of dad.
Right.
So sometimes there's extenuating circumstances that the clearance process doesn't allow for. It's very rigid. So for getting a clearance and a security background check in your favor, they look into your past. And if they see a foreign military or a foreign government contact, if you're an American, that is cause for concern. If you are a foreign person, it's much less controversial and unexpected. You know, everyone, I know people in the government. I imagine you know people in the government. It's probably not nefarious, but the Pentagon hasn't been able to sort of put those in context.
What are some of the reasons recruits are being told they didn't clear the background checks?
Well, those are some of the reasons that
they're being told those reasons. Okay.
they're being told that there's derogatory information. Right. Sometimes they own a business. I know of one recruit from China who had a business. It was like a grocery store, a small business, and that was so foreign money was tied up into another place, right? And the government says, well, maybe that is something that can be used against you, and you can be compromised. So there's a host of reasons, and one of the issues now is the Army is not coming back and telling recruits specifically why. They can request those documents through FOIA. Sometimes they get them. There was a soldier from Brazil who's been training for 2 years, and he sued the Army after they said, well, we're cutting you loose because of something we found. And he asked for his documents, and he got them, but they still try to kick him out. So he forced them into a lawsuit to explain why, because he said the Army violated its own rules. There was a potential violation of the Constitution of due process. And instead of the Army coming back in the court and saying, this is why we did it and we justified it, they just backed down and they reversed their decision. So it's not really clear what the Army strategy is, what kind of defense they are trying to maintain with some of these recruits. But in this high-profile case, at least in this instance, rather than show their math in court, they withdrew their objection.
Yeah, and I have to say, it seems a little suspicious, the idea that the government would back down from their original stance, particularly if it was sort of on the foundation that there was some kind of national security concern or some national interest in mind when making the decision, to back away from that entirely and to reverse course and to allow the soldier to complete the program seems fishy. I don't know. How do you read that?
Well, if you're going to make a decision that someone who's been training as a reservist for 2 years, you've already let them on base, you already let them be exposed to other folks, you have already made the determination through a complicated clearance process to let them in, and then to go say, well, maybe not, but then when you're challenged to walk away from it, it raises your eyebrow, right? Because it means that there are decisions being made that are not bulletproof on the Army's behalf,
right.
And so we're not really kind of sure where the pressure is coming from. If there's a White House position on this, are there internal Pentagon policy folks who are interested in seeing this go away? We're just not sure because this issue has been opaque for as long as I've been reporting, and that's April of last year. And one of the issues too is, the Pentagon has justified the rigorous screening through for the recruits as the reason why there's so many problems. But there have also been native-born troops who don't get that kind of screening that have been allowed to enlist. For instance, there is a documented neo-Nazi that was enlisted in the Marine Corps, and he was videotaped in Charlottesville last year. And then there was the case of an American with French U.S. Citizenry who fought on the Russian side in Ukraine and then came home and enlisted in the U.S. Army. And none of that was caught and none of that was investigated for both of those two people until reporting bared it out. So you really have to say, okay, well, if no one wants to let in security threats, no one wants to let in anyone who would compromise the security of the military and by extension the country, but you have to at some point say, okay, where are the resources going and are they being used in a responsible and efficient manner? If you have Americans joining that really have suspect ties and you are turning away people who have been vetted very vigorously for sort of circumspect or dubious reasons.
Right. So considering what you just said, citizens with questionable backgrounds documented not being subject to these background checks, and immigrants being thoroughly vetted, it's hard to see how this isn't xenophobia. I mean, how do you read that?
I mean, I can't make that call. I mean, I haven't seen any internal memos or emails that are deliberately
explicitly saying that, right?
Right. I mean, there is speculation, but you have to remember, and this is okay. Well, this is a problem with immigration and security during the Trump administration. But do remember that 2016 is when the rigorous background screening was implemented, and that was during the Obama administration, which, of course, you know, he wrongly or rightly earned the moniker deporter in chief for his hardline immigration stance. So there is the sort of concern, and a lot of times the overwrought fear has been rooted 2 years ago when Obama was president. So it's really difficult to understand where this all comes together. It's complicated, and there's folks in and out of the policy shop in the Pentagon who have their hand in this. So I can't make that claim.
I
don't know.
Right. So, but I do want to be clear on one point. It's true. Is it that the Pentagon is considering canceling enlistment contracts for 1,000 foreign-born recruits without immigration status, right?
So that was part of a Pentagon proposal document that we reported on last year for the Post. And it basically said, here's the program. We're going to shut this thing down because of its drain on resources and its complicated nature. And then it broke down the different recruit levels. There's people who are already in the force, and many have been naturalized. There was about 4,000, according to that planning document. And then they separated further for those who are waiting to get in, who have done all the steps, and all they're waiting for is their security checks to be done. And they identified that there, in that population, there were 1,000 that waited for so long because the Pentagon had created such a big mess, that there were 1,000 that were out of legal status, and they could have been subject to deportation if they were released. And in that document, the recommendation was to do that, to release them, and then to create a public affairs strategy that would handle the ensuing fallout. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen in mass. It's been happening, you know, in bits and pieces as people, for whatever reason, leave the program. It might be a fitness reason. It might be a security reason. It might be they no longer are interested and they leave voluntarily. But there are people who have, you know, stuck it out and waited years and just all of a sudden get a notice that they're out. One of the lawsuits against the government was that they were taking so long that there's a 2-year window for when you can enlist, and the Pentagon said, okay, well, we'll extend that to 3 years. So that's one of the consequences of the lawsuit that has helped people sort of stay in. Right. And USCIS will grant you a deferred action if you have an active contract. But if you get that canceled erroneously, then you're sort of lost without protection.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Washington Post reporter Alex Horton about his investigation into the treatment of immigrants serving in the U.S. military. Alex, I want you to tell us about some of the findings in a 2017 report from the RAND Corporation about the Manvi program.
Sure. And the findings in the report kind of bear out what the Army and Pentagon had already known, which was that folks in the program who come through by virtue of their needs and their backgrounds of what they bring, they're better educated. They're motivated more than, you know, your average U.S. Born soldier who doesn't have to go through all these hoops. And they tend to stay in the military longer. They have a lower attrition rate, which means they don't give up as quickly as other folks who maybe say, you know what, I'm in basic training and I can't cut it and I'm going to leave. So those are things that have already been known for years, that pound for pound, these recruits are better educated, better prepared. They're a little bit older. So they're a little bit, they take the thing like a career more seriously. And they're much more motivated to kind of get through the rigors of training than, you know, folks who were born in, you know, Missouri, Iowa, and Texas. It wasn't a major ask of the Pentagon, but the RAND Corporation in the report concluded, well, the Pentagon had asked about this, about the security threat assessment, and if this could be used for infiltration for our nefarious actors. They said, well, it's hard for us to assess that. We have to say the threat is zero because there are no known and publicly released incidents of someone using this to make threats or to do harm. There's only been assumptions and just sort of concerns, but nothing has really kind of bared out. So that was one of the findings that they found, and the RAND Corporation had never released that report. Interestingly enough,
Do you know why?
I don't know why. There's some speculation on it that it didn't really say what the Pentagon wanted it to say, and it wasn't released. I don't know. It came out, I believe, in a lawsuit through Discovery because it was never published publicly. So I can't say for certain. There is that speculation, but maybe it just wasn't done. Who knows? But it wasn't part of the light of day until, you know, the lawsuit kind of forced it out into the open.
Right. Well, you know, given that report and you, as you say, what the Pentagon already knew, it makes the rigor of the background checks seem perhaps unnecessary, or at least this is sort of scrutiny of them, if we can document that we've had good enlistees from the program.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to say that the security checks are unnecessary. You really have to say, or question, at what level do they become too burdensome or unnecessary, or how they should conform to this special population. Because if you're applying the same standards to foreign-born people who already have foreign contacts, maybe foreign military contacts, maybe businesses, then of course you're going to get a lot of false positives. I mean, that is sort of logically follows. So there is that question that the Pentagon really hasn't answered, is, okay, well, if you're getting so many rejections or issues coming through there now from the screening, is there a problem with the screening, or is it a problem with the pool of recruits? They haven't really been able to answer this question.
Republican Congressman Andy Harris is quoted as saying, "Our military must prioritize enlisting American citizens and restore the MAVNI program to its specialized limited scope." Is this notion antithetical to the program?
It sounds like it, because, you know, one of the Republican kind of criticisms of recent personnel policy decisions with the military has been calls of and criticisms of social engineering. Like when you have transgender folks who can openly enlist, or the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Republican outcry typically was, this is just, you know, progressives, you know, socially engineering and politically engineering a military force. That is not the case when it comes to MAVNI. The Bush administration decided this is a national security priority to support ongoing missions. This isn't a liberal feel-good operation. It's not something to make progressives happy. It's something the military identified as a need and got what it asked for. And it was especially true when it came to special operations, which has seen, you know, a kind of growing importance and sort of like a Swiss Army knife when it comes to military missions across the world, and probably too much so. They go into places that are austere, where they need to be able to trust someone who can speak the language that they're at. They don't have time or the resources to pluck someone from that country and teach them everything and trust them right away. So they were calling for this very early on, to have people in the force they can pluck to take them on missions all over the world. And that did happen in 2011. There was this Nepalese soldier who spoke native languages that were also spoken in Afghanistan, and he came through the program. He was in the army as a generator repairman, and the army plucked him to join to serve alongside these Green Berets in Afghanistan on their missions. I mean, he ended up, because of that, becoming Soldier of the Year in 2012. So that's not immigrant Soldier of the Year. That's not enlisted Soldier of the Year. That is Soldier of the Year. That means the Army identified him as the best person in about a million-person organization.
Yeah, and in that context, it's tremendous to think that this is a program that's been quietly, for the moment, discontinued, considering evidence like that. For many participants being denied, turned away from the Army, let's say, it's devastating not only for citizenship reasons, but for many, being in the U.S. military is their dream. And, you've talked to some of these individuals and their lawyers, and I'm wondering if you can talk to sort of just the emotional content for them, what this experience is like being essentially rejected in this way.
Sure. And I think, you know, I've spoken to perhaps dozens of these recruits over the past year plus, And one of the things, and this is true if anyone has ever met, you know, immigrant populations who've come here and lived here for a while, especially first generation, is they always speak about giving back. And they sort of, you know, believe and understand the JFK notion of, you know, ask what you can do for your country. So a lot of times they come from, you know, austere or dangerous conditions. They come from places that do not have democracies like Russia and China. They come from the Middle East, which has problems with their institutions and governments and persecution. So they come here and they live here for a few years and they want to become citizens. And the process is so onerous and so complicated and takes so long that they want to do two things. One, they want to do that. They want to do it quicker. And they want to repay the country in some way. And this sort of just became like a silver bullet to do all those things. So the thing I hear time and time again, especially from folks who are in this for a long time, is we want to do something for this country that took us in. So it becomes poisonous after a while to sort of have that idea that the government might put up a lot of roadblocks for that to happen if you are just you and you don't have any problems going through. I mean, most people who go through MAVNI will not have any security problems, just as, you know, the vast majority of Americans won't be neo-Nazis or fought in Russia, but there are some. You know, there is this one guy I spoke to, he was Iraqi, and he was a translator for American troops at the height of the surge. And he remembered troops, he respected them, he befriended them, and then he came to the United States and lived in Oregon, got his degree, got his master's degree, and he planned to enlist in this program. And he got caught up in this process, waiting for so long, and he wasn't gonna be a lawful immigrant anymore. He's gonna lose his status. And he said, well, he gave up, and mm-hmm. he went to Canada and registered for asylum. And then he received it based on the reporting that we did on him. So that's someone who is motivated, who had a special love for the country, and he left it. And the last time I talked to him, you know, he was pursuing perhaps serving in the Afghanistan military, or not the Afghanistan military, the Canadian military,
right?
Because that's his home now. He can't go back home. His biggest fear was some member of ISIS would find a Facebook photo of him enlisting. And they prowl airplanes, they prowl deportations. They know people are at their most sensitive and their most down at that moment. His greatest fear was walking into his hometown of Kirkuk and not walking out because ISIS captured him. Mm. So he went to Canada instead of staying here and trying his hand at the U.S. Army. So the Canadian military might have another recruit on their hands.
Wow. You know, you look at historic contexts like Vietnam and contemporaneous conditions like the Walter Reed Hospital, homeless and unemployed Iraqi veterans, the fact that the military hasn't met their 2018 benchmarks for recruits. Is this another strike against the U.S. military brand? Does this incident make the military look inefficient or incompetent?
There's two things happening here, one of which is, you know, if the thousands of recruits that were waiting last year, and in 2017, the Army missed its reserve recruit goals. If they had the process and if they had figured out the way to clear all these folks in, they would have met their, just from this program alone, they would have met their goal of mustering in folks. So that's one problem, that they're sort of, they have a captive audience for people who desperately want to get in and they're just turning them away. You know, some won't meet the standards, and that's okay, just like U.S.-born troops. But, you know, most of them are already kind of just – they're done with everything, and they're just waiting on the word. You know, they're fit. They're educated. Right. They don't have criminal records. They're ready to go, and the only thing that's stopping them is this process. The other thing, too, is, yeah, I mean, if you're thinking about a career in the military and you're American and you see this happening, it's like, well, you know, are there – is the force taking care of their folks? Does the Army and the military broadly understand its needs and invest in people the right way? And the third thing is, you know, we have a shooting war still in Afghanistan. We have troops dying in Niger. We have, you know, folks all over the country. We have Americans training Ukrainians and serving alongside them and going on exercises in the Balkans and South Korea, all over the world. I'm pretty confident in saying there's going to be another war somewhere where America is involved in, and they're going to need to learn this country and its languages and its culture in a hurry.
Right.
And this program might just come open again, because the Pentagon has a short memory, but it's able to look back in its files and say, okay, well, maybe that was a good idea. So I don't think that this is going to be the death of it. I think there's going to be another conflict where the need will arise, and sometimes the Pentagon has a goldfish moment where it forgets everything that it just did and remembers that it has a job to do. It might reinvigorate this thing. But the problem is, how are you going to then convince this population if they look back and see that this happened?
To come forward and to serve. Well, and for a society for more people are disconnected from military service, it's important to underscore the people that are willing to do this work for us. Thank you for coming on and discussing with me today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Washington Post reporter Alex Horton about his investigation into the treatment of immigrants serving in the U.S. military.